Leon refueled the butterfly from one of the 50-gallon drums that had been brought from Nairobi by Gustav in the big Meerbach truck. While he was doing this, he sent Manyoro and Loikot to the top of the hill above the camp to join in with the Maasai grapevine and gather any news that might be of interest. Once or twice he looked up from refueling to listen to the shrill distant voices calling to each other from hilltop to hilltop. The Chungaji used a type of verbal shorthand, and he could make out a few isolated words, but he could not follow the whole sense of their exchanges. Not long after he had topped up the last of the butterfly's four fuel tanks and was washing his hands in the basin in front of his tent, the two Maasai came down from the hill. They began to report to him the few items of interest they had gathered. It was said that on the next full moon, as was customary at this time of the year, Lusima would preside over a conference of the Maasai tribal elders on Lonsonio Mountain. She would sacrifice a white cow to the ancestors. The welfare of the tribe depended on the observance of these rituals. It was said also that there had been a raid by a war party of Nandi. They had run off 33 head of prime Maasai cattle, but the avenging Morani had caught up with them on the banks of the Tishimi River. They had recovered all the missing cattle and thrown the corpses of the rustlers into the river. The crocodiles had disposed of this evidence. At the moment, the district commissioner was holding an inquiry at Narosura, but it seemed that the entire area was suffering from an attack of amnesia. Nobody knew anything about stolen cattle or missing Nandi warriors. It was further said that four lions had come down into the Rift Valley from the direction of Kikorok, all young males. They had been given a drubbing by the big dominant male and driven out of the pride into which they had been born. He would not tolerate any competition when it came to breeding with his females. Two nights previously, the youngsters had killed six heifers from the Manyata directly to the west of Lonsonio Mountain. The call had gone out to the Morani to gather at this village, which was named Sonjo. They were going to deal out to these four cattle-killing lions a summary lesson in manners. Leon was pleased with this news. Graf Otto had expressed a keen desire to watch a ceremonial hunt, and this was a most fortuitous coincidence. He dispatched Manyoro to the Sonjo Manyata, which was hosting the lion hunters, with a gift of 100 shillings for the local chieftain and a request that he allow the Wazungu to be spectators at the hunt. By the time Graf Otto returned with Henny in the Vauxhall from butchering the buffalo carcasses, Leon had the horses saddled and the pack mules loaded with sufficient supplies for the side expedition to Sonjo. As his client disembarked, Leon hurriedly told him the good news. Graf Otto was excited. "Quickly, Eva! We must change into riding clothes and go at once. I do not want to miss the show." They pushed the horses along at a canter, covering almost 20 miles, before it became too dark to see the ground ahead. Then they dismounted and unsaddled. They ate a cold dinner and slept rough. The next morning they were away again before it was fully light. Some time before noon the next day, as they neared the village of Sonjo, they heard drums and singing. Manyoro had come from the village to await their arrival and was squatting beside the track. He stood up and came to meet the horses. "All is arranged, Mbogo. The chief of the Manyata has agreed to delay the hunt until you arrive. But you must hurry. The Morani are becoming restless. They are eager to blood their spears and win honour. The chief cannot keep them on the leash much longer." The Morani were gathered in the centre of the cattle pen, an elite band who had been selected by the elders, the bravest and the best. They were young men, 50 strong, dressed in red leather kilts decorated with ivory beads and cowrie shells. Their naked torsos gleamed with a coating of fat and red ochre. Their hair was dressed in an elaborate style of coiled plaits. They were lean and long-limbed, hard and elegantly muscled, their features handsome and hawkish, eyes bright and rapacious, showing their eagerness for the hunt to begin. They had formed up in a single rank, shoulder to shoulder. At their head was a senior Morani, an experienced warrior who wore 5 lion tails in his kilt, one for every Nandi he had killed in single combat. His war bonnet was the headskin of a black-maned lion, further proof of his prowess. Single-handed, he had taken the lion with the assegai. He had a signal whistle made from the horn of a reed buck hanging on a thong around his neck. Several hundred older men with women and children lined the outer stockade to watch the dance. The women clapped and ululated. As the three whites rode into the maniata, the drums took on an ever more savage and frenetic rhythm. The drummers pounded on the hollow logs, working the warriors into a fighting frenzy, until they broke into the lion dance, singing and bounding high in the air on stiff legs, grunting like lions as they came back to earth. Then the leader blew a shrill command on his whistle, and the troop began to sally forth from the cattle pen, retaining their single file. Evenly spaced, they formed a long, sinuous serpent, which wound away down the grassy slope, the sunlight reflecting in bright sparks off the steel of their assegais. They carried on their shoulders their long rawhide shields, each painted with a single large eye of black and ochre, the pupil glaring white.
"Why do they have eyes on their shields, Otto?"
Eva asked.
"Answer the question, Courtney.
The Marani say they will provoke the lions into charging. Come, we must not be left behind. When it happens, it will happen very fast." The riders followed the long, winding file of warriors.
"How do they know where to find the quarry?" Graf Otto asked.
"They have scouts watching over the lions," Leon answered. "But the lions will not have gone far. They have killed 6 cattle, and they will not leave until they have finished all that meat." Manyoro was running at Leon's stirrup. He said something, and Leon stooped in the saddle to listen to him. When he straightened up, he told Graf Otto,
"Manyoro says the dead cattle are lying in a shallow basin over the next rise."
He pointed ahead.
"If we circle out to the right and take our position on the high ground, we will have a grandstand view."
He led them off the track, and they cantered in a wide circle to get ahead of the file of Marani, reaching the lookout point as the head of the long line of warriors breasted the ridge and started down into the basin. Manyoro had given them good advice. When they reined in on the crest, they had a fine view over the grassy dale. The rotting carcasses of the cattle lay in full view, bellies ballooned with gas. Some had been partially devoured, but others seemed untouched. Now the single file of warriors changed formation. As they reached a predetermined spot, each Marani turned in the opposite direction to the man in front of him. Like a chorus line of well-choreographed dancers, the single file split into two. The twin lines opened to form a noose that would encircle the grassy hollow. Then, at a sharp blast on the whistle, the heads of the files of warriors began to converge. Swiftly, the maneuver was completed. A wall of shields and spears ringed the basin.
"I cannot see the lions," Eva said. "Are you sure they have not escaped?"
But before either man could answer her, a lion stood up in full view. He had been lying flat against the earth, his coat blending perfectly with the sun-scorched brown grass. Although he was young, he was big and rangy. His mane was short and sparse, a mere fuzz of red hair. He snarled at the Marani, his lips peeling back from his long bright fangs. They returned his greeting.
"We see you, evil one! We see you, killer of our cattle!"
The sound of 50 voices alarmed the other lions. They rose from their hiding places in the short grass, crouched low and glared with eyes of topaz yellow at the ring of shields. Their tails twitched nervously. They snarled and growled with fear and anger. They were young, and this was beyond their experience. The buckthorn whistle shrilled again, and the Marani began to chant the chorus of the lion song. Then, still singing, they moved forward in unison, shuffling and stamping. Slowly they closed in on the four lions as a python tightens its coils on its prey. One lion made a short mock charge at the wall, and the Marani shook their shields and called to him,
"Come, come, we are ready to welcome you."
The lion broke off his charge, coming up short on stiff front legs. He glared at the men, then spun around and ran back to join his siblings. They circled and milled uneasily, growling, and erected their manes in a threatening display, making short rushes at the wall of shields, then breaking off and turning back.
"The one with the ginger mane will be the first to charge home," Graf Otto made his judgment.
And as he spoke, the largest of the four lions launched himself in a swift, determined charge straight at the shields.
The senior Mirani, with the black mane headdress, blew a blast on his buckthorn whistle. Then, with his spear, he pointed out a man in the file who was directly in the line of the charge. He shouted the man's name.
Kachikoi!
The warrior who had been chosen sprang high in the air to acknowledge the honour, then broke out of the line and raced to meet the charging lion with long, bounding strides. His comrades egged him on with a savage, rising ululation. The lion saw him coming and swerved towards him, grunting with each stride, a tawny streak snaking low against the ground, his black-tufted tail slashing against his flanks. His glittering yellow eyes were fastened on Kachikoi. As they came together, the Mirani altered the angle of his charge, turning into the lion, forcing him to come in from the right into his spear arm. Then he dropped on one knee behind his shield. The point of his assegai was aimed at the centre of the lion's chest, and the beast ran straight onto the steel. The long silver blade disappeared with magical suddenness, full length into the tawny body. Kachikoi released his grip on the haft, leaving the blade buried in the lion's chest. He raised the rawhide shield, and the lion crashed headlong into it. He did not try to resist the weight and momentum of the great cat's leap. Instead, he rolled over backwards and curled himself into a ball, holding the shield interposed. Despite the assegai which transfixed him, the lion's strength and rage were undiminished. He tore at the shield with both front paws, the yellow claws raking deep gouges in it. He was growling hideously and trying to bite into the shield, but the leather had dried iron hard, and his fangs could not find a grip. The huntmaster blew a short blast on his buckhorn, and four of Kachikoi's comrades left the ring of warriors and raced forward, then separated, two on each side. The lion was concentrating all his effort on Kachikoi, so he did not see them coming until they had him surrounded. Their assegais rose and fell as repeatedly they drove the long blades deep into the lion's vital organs. The beast gave a mighty groan that carried clearly to the horsemen on the rise, then collapsed and rolled off the shield. He stretched out and lay still. Kachikoi sprang to his feet, seized the handle of his assegai, placed one foot on the lion's chest, and drew the blade clear. Brandishing the bloody steel, he led his four companions back to their places in the ring of warriors. They were greeted with shouts of acclamation that seemed to ring against the sky and a salute of raised spears. Then the ring of Mirani moved forward again, tightening inexorably around the remaining three lions. As the ring contracted, the warriors compacted into a solid wall, the outer edges of their shields overlapping. In the centre, the three lions rushed back and forth, seeking escape. They charged, then broke off and turned back with tails between their legs. At last, one screwed its courage to the fatal point and charged home. The Mirani who met him drove the blade of his assegai fully home. But as he went over backwards with the lion on top, its claws hooked around the edge of the shield and ripped it aside, exposing the man's head and his naked torso. While its claws tore the man's chest open, the mortally wounded lion opened its jaws to their full extent and engulfed the man's head. It bit down until the long fangs interlocked, crushing the human skull like a walnut in a nutcracker. The dead man's comrades speared the lion in a fury of vengeance. In quick succession, the last two lions charged into the front rank of warriors, which broke over them like an ocean wave upon a rock. They died under the spears, crackling with snarls, lashing out with hooked claws and desperate futility, as the razor steel stabbed deeply into them. His circumcision brothers lifted the torn body of the dead Mirani out of the grass and laid him on his shield. Then, to the full extent of their raised arms, they lifted him high in the air and bore him home singing his praise song. As they passed the watchers on the hilltop, Graf Otto lifted a clenched fist in a salute to the corpse. The Mirani acknowledged it with raised assegais and a wild shout.
"There was a man who died a man's death," Graf Otto spoke with solemn intensity, a tone Leon had not heard him use before, and lapsed into silence. All three were deeply moved by the sublime tragedy. Then Graf Otto spoke again. what I have witnessed here today makes all the ethics of the hunt that I have believed in seem ignoble. How can I count myself a true hunter till I have stood to meet such a magnificent beast with only a spear in my hand?"
He swiveled in the saddle and glared at Leon.
"This is not a request, Courtney. It is an order. Get me a lion, a full-grown, black-maned lion. I will take him on foot. No guns. Just the beast and me."